Marin. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. All right. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. How are you? Angry puppets, please cut your strings and run, will you? It's me, Mark Maron. I am back. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning.
I am here to play the role of resident dead man walking for as long as it takes, my friends. But until then, we will continue doing our show. 83 years ago today, Nazi forces surrounded a German beer hall where Bavarian government officials were meeting with local business leaders. Adolf Hitler burst in with a bunch of Nazi stormtroopers, shot off his pistol, and declared that the National Revolution has begun. 3 days later, he was arrested and put in jail, where he wrote Mein Kampf and practiced his speech-giving skills. And the rest is history, my friends. And not so coincidentally, 11 years ago today, the Republican Party won control of the Senate and the House of Representatives, ending 60 years of mostly Democratic rule. No arrests were made, but those are forthcoming. Soon. I think they might be happening. So, Riley, I was away for a long weekend. I was up in Boston. I had never seen anything so beautiful as the trees turning colors. It's been years since I've seen that. And it's interesting when you see something beautiful and it's interspersed with, you know, momentary anxiety and dread for one's future, how the experience is sort of soured, but nonetheless beautiful. There are moments like, oh, it's orange and red and I'm in trouble. What the hell am I going to do with my life? But look at the colors.
Did you go up Jimmy Tingle's?
I did not. I went actually by a place called the Comedy Studio. I didn't tell anybody. It was sort of stealth, but they had a full crowd in there nonetheless.
Do you like Boston, Mark?
Do I like Boston? Well, you know, honestly, I spent a lot of my life in Boston, Brendan McDonald, and I spent like 7 or 8 years there going to school and going through these formative parts of my life. And there's some part of me where I travel around the city, and it's sort of nostalgic now. I can't believe it's been 20-some-odd years where I kind of drive around. It's like, oh, I threw up there. Oh, that's where my drug dealer lived. Hey, that's where I had the identity crisis. That was that. Oh, I remember that place. I had that panic attack there. It's almost I wish I could go back to the source and throw the ring into the lake of fire and maybe release myself of the curse.
So you have good memories of it, though.
I do have some good memories.
That's funny, because I kind of remember this some time ago. We were having a conversation, and I remember... I remember you saying this.
Nowhere else do you have to f***ing tolerate that f***ing. How are you? Who farted? It's like, what the f***? Where the f*** do you people come from?
Jesus Christ. Know how to f***ing learn how to talk. Rhode Island's even f***ing worse. It's a f***ing disaster. You know what I mean? I was run out of Boston by that f***ing accent. Hey, Mac! It's Mark! What the f*** is wrong with you? Mac! Mac! The reason I'm not responding is it's Mark. How are you? What the f***? Mac. Come here, Mac. Want a hummer?
All right.
Give me a hummer. You know, those candid moments in the sound room, you don't think are going to make it to air, but that's nice.
Mac, how are you, Mac?
There was that issue, but there were some very beautiful things about Boston as well. And, you know, I it's weird, though, because I don't ever go back. I was there for 7 years, and there's no place in my life where I really, like, I have to go back. I like to go back to other places, but I just rarely go back there. And I think, I used to think it was because of some of that, but it's really because, hell, you know, I mean, after a certain point, when you have a big chunk of your life spent somewhere, going back is just a reminder of when you were young, and who the hell needs that? Do you know what I mean? After a certain point, it's like, oh yeah, I remember. I had ideals. I thought I was going to be something. Yeah, I went through so many different phases in Boston in my college years. And sometimes when you go back, the nostalgia is too much. And then with everything else, but we did go up to Newburyport. We walked around. We did the New England thing. We saw her relatives. And outside of the momentary lapses of panic about my future, everything was good. So let's get into this, Riley, because I know you certainly have got an angle on this. Outside of Ferrer and Bloomberg, I want you to tell me the gossip about this John Corzine race in New Jersey. I mean, we were on the phone last night, and this is why politics stinks. And this is why, you know, you rarely find representation that you can believe in, because it gets so damn dirty. Is that what's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's election day, and I think maybe some polls on the East Coast have already opened. Mm-hmm. But what we have in New Jersey, Mark, was just an extraordinary amount of ugliness in the last few days leading up to today.
Yeah.
It started last Wednesday when the New York Times printed an article by John Corzine's, they quoted John Corzine's ex-wife saying essentially that he let his family down and that he would let New Jersey down as well. That same day, Doug Forrester, Corzine's Republican opponent for the gubernatorial seat in New Jersey, said he would not use that quote in a campaign ad, or would not use any of the substance of the article in the campaign ad.
Yeah, but
the next day,
right?
The campaign ad, a 15-second spot came out where they actually scrolled Corzine's ex-wife's quote, saying that he would let New Jersey down. One day after that, on Friday, Thursday of last week, there were email reports, rumors, and blog entries to the effect that Doug Forrester, the Republican nominee, had an affair with a former Miss New Jersey who worked on his Senate bid in 2002. Okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop. It's not finished.
Okay. Keep it coming.
Okay.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah.
There was a report that John Corzine allegedly paid for an abortion for a staffer that he allegedly had an affair with. Now, the affair stuff both candidates have vehemently denied. Forrester has denied having an affair with the former Miss New Jersey, who's now a lobbyist, and Corzine vehemently denies paying for an abortion and having an affair with this former staffer of his.
You know, it makes me sick, you know, because I know that this has been going on since the beginning of politics. I know this type of mudslinging, this slander, and this crap has been going on since the beginning of politics, and it's the way races are run. But how the hell is anyone supposed to make a judgment about what is good for their city, what is good for their state, what is good for the country, when this kind of crap just is constantly thrown at each other? It makes the whole thing completely disrespectful. Not that it's not disrespectful already, but it diminishes any sort of real issue politics.
You know what it does? It keeps people home.
Yeah.
People sit up and they wake up today and they say, you know what? These people are both two peas of the same pod, and I don't want to be bothered with either of them. And some of this sleaze has made the current acting governor, who's not running for anything, the most popular politician in the state of New Jersey.
just for sitting there,
not doing nothing.
Just for hanging out. Now, this is sort of sad. A Quinnipiac University poll released yesterday on the New York City gubernatorial race showed Michael Bloomberg with a 38-point lead over Freddie Ferrer. And Freddie is still out there campaigning. Riley, I feel like we should call him. And I tell you, these guys have nads of steel. If this would have been me yesterday when I saw those numbers, I would, screw it. I don't need this.
Well, you know, that wasn't the only one. There were three polls that came out on the New York City mayoral race since Friday.
Right.
The lowest one was 30 points.
Oh.
Okay. 30, 34, 38. That's the margin. And the 38, the Quinnipiac poll, which was released yesterday, gave Bloomberg 68% to Fernando Ferrer's 30%.
So what does he stand to gain by continuing the campaign? Isn't there something, this is something I'm battling with right now in my own life, is that isn't there something to be said for the guy that just stands up and goes, all right, I had enough, to hell with this, I don't need it.
No, okay, not in politics.
Okay, because that will be remembered as a guy who did that as opposed to the guy that just ate the crow and went on?
That will be remembered as that person's last foray into the political arena. Once you give up before an election, you might as well not run for dog catcher ever again in life. Sell insurance, go behind a bar, do something. But so, don't get into politics again, because no one is going to ever back someone who acknowledges ahead of time that he or she is a loser.
So save the sour grapes for after the election? Is that what you're saying?
Well, there'll be plenty of finger-pointing right after the election. That's why Hillary Clinton, by the way, was on the road and on the stump with Fernando Ferrer over this past weekend, so nobody can say she didn't do her part.
So what happens then is Ferrer, though he loses, is able to either blame people himself or be used in some other way, but does he have a future in politics?
It's an interesting question. He will not be the person dispersing blame. It will be Democrats generally who are going to say, wait a minute, this is a 4-1 Democrat town, yet this will be the fourth term that a Republican has won the mayoralty. That's 16 consecutive years that a Democratic town has elected a Republican mayor. And I think that this entire race will be seen in that context. Mike Bloomberg, by the way, has spent at last count, as of last Friday, $66 million. The two candidates in New Jersey, Corzine and Forrester, have spent a combined $72 million. So you realize how much money Mike Bloomberg has been spending, because both Corzine and Forrester are multimillionaires.
I'll tell you something. If I were just an American person, I saw that kind of money being spent, and you know it's being spent and wasted on these kind of election tactics, I would be completely disappointed. It's when I started to learn, like, just like when you start to learn how much money actors make, you get this feeling of sort of like, that guy gets that much for doing that. That guy spending that kind of money to buy my vote. It makes me not respect them, and it makes me have a certain amount of contempt towards that waste of money.
Well,
and,
by the way, we got other numbers coming out later today that will even make you more contemptuous.
All right.
So stay tuned.
I will. Rioting in France last night spread to 300 towns in a couple of different countries, and we're going to have somebody to tell us exactly what is going on there. We got Newsweek Paris Bureau Chief Christopher Dickey is going to join us on the phone in a minute to let us know what's going on. So stick around. 16 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition, my friends. We're going to get into some more top news in a second. Iraq torture, local elections around the country, what's important. But right now, the rioting in France claimed its first victim yesterday when a 61-year-old retired auto worker died in a hospital from injuries sustained on Friday. Meanwhile, the rioting continues in France with reports of copycat attacks taking place in both Brussels and Berlin. Our next guest is Newsweek's Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor Christopher Dickey joins us by phone with the latest developments from Paris. Good morning, Christopher. What's the current situation in France right now?
Good morning, Mark. Well, it was a little bit more quiet last night than it had been the previous couple of nights. There were only about 800 cars burned around the country. We were up, getting up to 1,300-1,400 burned a night previously. Obviously, the first death has shocked people. I think that's in some ways had a calming influence. The big news, of course, is that they're going to start imposing curfews in a lot of these neighborhoods. So you'll have the police moving in there and just rounding up anybody who's out on the street after a certain hour. And that should also tend to calm them down. But that's a very radical move for France. This is a law that hasn't been applied basically since 1955 during the Algerian War.
Wow. So, Christopher Dickey, let me ask you a question, because I'm reading over a lot of the releases, the news releases that are coming out of France. And now, given that most of these protesters or rioters, I guess is what they would be, setting fire to things and causing all this chaos are Muslim, is there any indication that there is some sort of jihadist recruiting situation going on?
Well, not directly in connection with these riots and these incidents, but there has been jihadist recruiting in these same neighborhoods among these same kids for a long time. And what we saw in Clichy-sous-Bois, which was where all this started, was that calm was restored after 4 days. And who restored it? Not the police. It was the mosque that restored calm. Now, that's not to say that the mosques or jihadists or Islamists are directing any of this, but they tap into the same anger. And the respect for the heritage of Islam, if you will, is probably greater than the notion of the French Republic that is being pushed by the government right now.
Now, there was a fatwa released, wasn't there, from the largest Muslim fundamentalist organization there in France?
Yes. I mean, the Muslim organizations here, certainly the mainstream organizations, are saying, calm down. This is not Islam. This is not something you want to do. And let's be clear. These kids are not kids who are going to mosque five times a day.
Right.
These kids identify more with 50 Cent than they do with,
right.
50 Cent than they do with, Islam. But it's a question of respect and manhood and sort of the image in the community. And you do have young men who are associated with the mosque who have a lot of respect in the community, and you have had over time, really dating back more than 15 years, you've had Islamists and jihadists sort of cruising these neighborhoods looking for people that they could persuade to prove their manhood by becoming martyrs in the great jihad.
Christopher Dickey, how close is the government to arresting the person or persons who beat that man to death?
We don't know. Apparently, it was one guy.
See, we've been hearing conflicting reports. There's one report that says it was a gang of people. There was another report that it was one guy.
No, well, the reports that I would rely on most have said that it was one guy, but you really, it's hard to know what happened. It's not clear that anybody saw exactly what happened in the incident, and it was a guy who seems to have been doing the beating or most of the beating was a guy wearing, you know, a hoodie. He was wearing a hood up over his head, so nobody's sure who he was. Of course, there are people who know. There are people in the gangs and in the community who will know, and they probably will turn him in at some point because that's pushing it further than anybody wanted this to go. I think you have to look at this and compare it, for instance, to the violence that's erupted every so often in the United States over the years, which is a hell of a lot more deadly than what's been happening here. You know, all of France may be seeing cars being burned and in some places confrontations with the police, but this is one person dead. In the L.A. riots in 92, there were more than 50 people killed.
All right, Christopher Dickey, now it seems that there is some violence bleeding over into Germany. Where is it at now? Is it still spreading? Do you feel that this is starting to simmer down? What's the momentum?
It feels like in the communities where a lot of this has been raging for the last 10 days, it's starting to slow down. It's kind of burning itself out. The police have made a lot of arrests. They're being tough, but not terribly violent. So they haven't created any new martyrs. They haven't created any new causes for violence, mm-hmm. generally, which is a good thing. Also, the communities themselves are just getting worn out. I mean, these are working class and pretty poor communities. It's quite a loss to have your car burned in front of your apartment. And so you've got a reaction within the communities that says, don't do this. And the dynamic of this was that these were essentially gangs of young men who were on their home turf and very turf conscious. And mm-hmm. they were luring the police in there and fighting with them on their home turf. Well, now a lot of that home turf is not as friendly to them as it was. So all of that is tending to calm the situation down. Problem is copycat actions, the kinds of things we saw spreading all over France and now, as you mentioned, up into Belgium and into Germany a little bit, where people are saying, well, they burned 15 cars in that neighborhood. We can do 20 cars in our neighborhood.
All right, well, I'm glad to hear that it's starting to settle down a bit for all those reasons. Christopher Dickey, thank you for joining us. It was great talking to you.
Thanks a lot, Christopher.
All right, thanks, Mark.
Okay, take care. That was Paris Bureau Chief for Newsweek. Christopher Dickey is also the Middle East Regional Editor. When we come back in just a second, we're going to talk about George W. Bush's proud exclamation that we don't torture, but from all indications, we do, and they want to do it more. So stick around for that. 27 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Get out there and vote. It's the vote day. It's election day. Do it up. Go out there and do it. Do your civic duty. Vote for the person you believe in or for the person that has been made to look less like a fool by the other guy, if that's what you base your vote on. You know what I mean?
I guess maybe some people do it that way.
Of course. Or they just do the old sort of like, oh, he looks like a nice guy. Look, he's got that hair. All right. Given that the Senate passed legislation banning torture against White House opposition, and Alberto Torquemada Gonzalez helped draft the new rules for the U.S. military that works around the Geneva Conventions, and, of course, we have an entire slideshow of photographs from Abu Ghraib, the president saying yesterday.
We are gathering information about where the terrorists may be hiding. We are trying to disrupt their plots and plans. Anything we do to that effort, to that end, in this effort, any activity we conduct is within the law. We do not torture.
Yeah, well, that was yesterday during a speech in Panama City. There, you know, if you look at the slideshow, you know, if you really think about what this guy is saying, what does he consider torture? You know, given that the neocon death cult put the laws in place that define torture, which is basically anything. Anything up till death is considered intense questioning. And then after death, it's considered the bad actions of an underling or a bad apple. I mean, if you just look at what we have, if you see the pictures like this picture of a guy who's got a growling dog about ready to bite off his genitals. Or how about this one? This is the picture of the person standing on the boxes with the electrodes hooked up to him with the hood on. Or how about this picture? Here we see Lindy England smiling with the guy on the leash. You know, or how about this picture? You remember that? Oh, this is the one. This is the dead guy that died from torture. There you go. Look at that. Oh, this is another dead guy. And there we have, this is the one that everyone thought was so funny, the stack of naked bodies. How can this guy say, number one, that we don't torture? And in the face of what's going on, you know, with John McCain and this this amendment, or I guess it's a, would it be called an amendment? Yes.
Yes.
About the against torture. The bottom line is, Riley, am I wrong? Dick Cheney wants to continue torture. Dick Cheney has been going over there and meeting with senators saying, look, you want to say what you're going to say about torture, but look, you got to change the language for the CIA. The CIA has got to be allowed to do whatever the hell they want to these guys.
It looks as though, for all the world, the Bush administration is shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic when it comes to torture. On the one hand, Bush says we do not torture. On the other hand, he refuses to deny that there are secret CIA prisons scattered throughout Eastern Europe, which are so secret that I'm not even sure anyone knows what goes on there. And you have to ask yourself why. Are they just like, you know, having conversations with these people that are incarcerated there? Or are they using some extreme interrogation techniques, which in English is torture?
And also, if they're not torturing, why don't they just say, okay, the amendment sounds great, fellas, good idea. It's because they are afraid, Dick Cheney is afraid that if you started some of this language, because there's a new policy directive that is supposed to govern interrogations out in the field, that guys are supposed to have this manual, how do I question this guy? What's okay? What isn't okay? And Cheney's got problems with the language of the Geneva Convention because it doesn't enable them to push the limits with this stuff. I think that's part of the policy problem is that Cheney wants the CIA to have those prisons. He wants the CIA to be able to beat the hell out of these guys, to torture them any way possible. And I think the bottom line is, Riley, what we've heard from people who were there in interrogations, that torture does not render results.
No, it doesn't render results. But, Mark, this gets back to something that you've been saying for a long time. The question of the extent to which the Bush administration is trying to backdate justification of the war in Iraq in the first place. That's what they're, in fact, trying to do with this. They are trying for all the world to get some little nugget of information that will say to the American people, yes, it was worth it to go in Iraq. Because right now, you see the polling. You see how the Bush administration's rationale
right.
is going up before its very eyes. Well, the only way I think a guy like Dick Cheney figures they'll get any justification, any rationale, is by squeezing it out of one of these guys they've got in custody, and that's why they've hidden these people out and they're torturing them.
But don't we find, Riley, that from all indication, when they squeeze these guys, a lot of times they'll just give them information they think they want.
They lie like rugs.
Well, yeah, they'll throw a lie out there that will cause, you know, taxpayers and American lives to be put on the, you know, in a dangerous position to go investigate these lies or to send a signal to other Muslim jihadists who see whatever the lie is. Like, I imagine, I have not been validated on this, that if someone if a detainee under torture says, yeah, go to this place and do that because there's a guy there that's doing something bad. And if the military goes there, that's a signal to other jihadists to realize that that guy's been caught and that we've got to change our plans. I think they're using us. And anytime you torture one of these guys, as soon as word gets out, that was what that movie The Enemy Within was all about. Mm-hmm. It was about a guy who was tortured for months and months and months, and it converted him to an extreme type of jihadism that becomes a danger to American soldiers.
Well, yeah, and you're looking also, Mark, at a situation where the entire Bush administration terror apparatus, and when I say apparatus, I'm talking about not just the secret prison facilities, not just the CIA's ability to torture, but the entire notion of how people are tried under these circumstances. You know, they just brought charges against 9 of the 500 people who were being held in Guantanamo, I think, as a carrot to people who are saying, look, you just can't hold them there forever without charging them with something, without trying to bring them before some form of justice. And that's, I think, at the root of what Bush and Cheney want to maintain. This notion that you can just pocket somebody, you can just disappear a person, rendition them, put them in a prison somewhere, just keep them out of sight, out of mind, and people, sooner or later, will stop asking where they are.
Right, except for the people that know where he is, and they're on their same side. side, and all it does is fester the anger. I think that this guarantees the conflict. Let's listen to something that Carl Levin said way back, I guess it's back in 2004. Back in 2004, this is Carl Levin.
The despicable actions described in General Taguba's report not only reek of abuse, they reek of an organized effort and methodical preparation for interrogation. The collars used on prisoners, the dogs, and the cameras did not suddenly appear out of thin air.
That was Senator Carl Levin. That was in May 2004 after the Taguba report was released. That was a report prepared by Major General Antonio Taguba on alleged abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad. Now, there is no way that this guy, that George Bush, can say we don't torture given that history. But the sad thing about it is there's a lot of people in this country that think it's justified. And one of those was then Senator James Inhofe. Also, this was in May 2004, responding to the Taguba report. That's how you say it, Inhofe or Inhofe? Inhofe, right?
Yeah, Inhofe.
This is him justifying torture. And these are the two different points of view. There are people like us who believe that no matter how much you torture somebody, it's not going to get any results. And it really is just what it does is it serves to promote more violence.
Well, of course.
It is violent and it promotes more violence on all levels. It's a violent seed. And then you get people like this. This is Senator Inhofe, who was a senator in Oklahoma in May 2004, talking about the Taguba report.
You know, they're not there for traffic violations. If they're in cell block 1A or 1B, these prisoners, they're murderers, they're terrorists, they're insurgents. Many of them probably have American blood on their hands. And here we're so concerned about the treatment of those individuals.
Without an international, you know, sort of parameter on how to treat prisoners and detainees, it's going to feed constant violence. That's all that I can say.
Well, yeah, and see, now you have the Supreme Court hearing a case that involves, and sounds absolutely absurd, Osama bin Laden's driver, okay? The guy who drove him around, he's being charged with conspiracy to commit murder and these other offenses, but he is one of those people that Bush has tried to subject to a military tribunal.
And that's going to be heard, that the tribunals are under fire.
Yes.
So that's going to be heard by the Supreme Court.
Minus John Roberts, who already voted with the government on this.
And when he was with the appeals court.
Appeals court,
right,
Third Circuit.
A panel of three judges. So he has to recuse himself from the whole hearing of this case?
He has to recuse himself from voting on the case, which means that it is possible there will be a 4-4 deadlock. And in fact, the lawyer for bin Laden's driver wants Roberts to hear the case and vote on it so there won't be a 4-4 deadlock.
Well, you know what? We should go into a little detail with this because if I were just listening to us talk about that, I'd want a little detail. I need a little detail from you. So let's do that in a second. Let's talk about why the new Supreme Court Chief Justice has to recuse himself from hearing a case about terrorism in relation to the military tribunals as being unorthodox and perhaps illegal. It's 44 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Edition.
Hey, this is Rob Zombie, and it says here, when I'm watching the sunrise after a long night of waking the dead and toasting nachos in the microwave, I listen to Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We're going to talk about these military tribunals. We're going to talk about John Roberts having to recuse himself from hearing a case involving the, I guess it would be the properness of a military tribunal, if there's such a thing. Now, these things were put in place after 9/11 to deal specifically with terrorism. They had not been used since World War II, the military tribunal system of justice, if you call it that. Well, now it's coming to question in the case of Osama bin Laden's driver. We're going to talk about that in a second, but first let's do this, because sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily we have an iNews Wi-Fi 5000 headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. All right, here we go from ABC News. Bush backing still sought in close campaign races. Bush backing still sought in close campaign races. Translation, desperate candidates clutch at remaining shards of influence. From CNN, escaped killer captured drunk. Escaped killer captured drunk. Translation, George Bush cornered in White House basement. from Reuters, a Vietnamese official says, stop feeding chicken feces to fish. Vietnamese official says, stop feeding chicken feces to fish. Translation, waiter says, restaurant no longer has dinner special number six. Hello, dinner special number six. Okay, here's another translation for that. Chicken feces finally set aside for nation's poor. You know what I found is that the second one, when I read two, never doesn't, for some reason, without the machine noise. You got to either do the whole thing, the whole ramp up, or nothing at all. That's what I say. All right, so as I said before, with these military tribunals, this fella, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, is being held on terrorist charges. He was the driver of Osama bin Laden. He claims that he's innocent of organizing or being part of terrorist plots. He has been held captive, or not captive, he's a detainee, and he is supposed to be put before a military tribunal. Now, somebody is arguing this, that the military tribunals are improper. This was on the advice of a Washington judge who said the process has not been followed properly, and it may not be a proper process at all. Now, this is going before the Supreme Court. Now, the interesting thing about this is the new Chief Justice, John Roberts, was part of a panel of district judges.
Yeah, I was wrong about that. It wasn't the Third Circuit. It was the D.C. Circuit.
That ruled against Hamdan. It is in question now whether or not he should have recused himself from that panel, even, because he was being considered for Chief Justice at that time. But right now, he's not going to be part of this hearing. Now, what do we stand to gain from this, Riley?
All right, it's very simple. This is a question of presidential power, as are many of the issues that the administration is facing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is whether or not a guy like Hamdan, who may be a peripheral player. I mean, he was the guy's driver, for God's sake. He wasn't discussing strategy, I hope.
Though he might have heard a little.
He might have heard a little bit of this, yeah, or that, and the other.
Yeah.
And if they want to try him for not cooperating, that's something different. But they are charging him with conspiracy to commit murder. He can be killed if he's convicted on these charges.
In the military tribunal. So this is what this is an attempt for the laws to be respected, for regular courts. What they're trying to do now is move these terrorists into the legal system, the proper legal system that this country guarantees.
That's right. And the Bush administration, from the very beginning, has vigorously resisted the idea of putting terror suspects on trial in American courts. Apparently, the administration feels that the burden of proof is too high in American courts, and that it's easier to put these guys in front of military tribunals. You remember the name Jose Padilla?
Sure.
Who, by the way, is still in custody. He was one of the test cases where they wanted to do the same kind of thing with him.
So thematically, what's going on here with the torture issue is that this is the neocon death cult, the administration, and the operatives of the administration, the bureaucracies underneath it, the Pentagon, the CIA, wanting to hold on to control of what they're seeing as this terrorist situation by being able to do whatever the hell they want and to determine those rules however they want to determine them.
Absolutely. And what is scary about this, Mark, is that America is supposed to be better than this. No one objects to bringing criminals to justice, all right? If they're terrorists, if they're people who have harmed the people of the United States or conspired to do so, then they should be tried, convicted, and sent away. No one has a problem. Certainly, I don't have a problem with that.
Right.
I don't think you have a problem
but
with that.
But the problem comes is if you or I could be picked up, thrown into detention without
That's
being
right.
charged, without being told what we're suspected of, without being represented by a lawyer.
And that's happened, by the way, to two or three Americans since September 11th. Remember the guy, I think he was up in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
who they arrested, locked the guy up, kept him incommunicado, and then it turned out he was perfectly innocent. It was a case of mistaken identity.
Well, that happens as well when somebody's relative is involved in something, they can be picked up and thrown away without the key. And that is another thing that festers a type of violent resentment towards the way we do things here. We should be a barometer of integrity on a legal level and also on a moral level in how we treat, you know, detainees or prisoners or and treat legal matters in general. But instead, we're becoming like third worldish.
Well, yeah, we're becoming third worldish. And guess who's noticing? The third world.
It just seems to me that, and this is what's interesting, the neocon death cult, the Bush administration, has argued that it is unnecessary for the Supreme Court to hear the case because the Pentagon had relaxed its rules for tribunals. So they're basically saying that now they allow some of the classified info to be shared with the defendants, and some of them can see a lawyer. So what do we need to go through all this rigmarole for? They're still trying to protect their policy of being able to do whatever the hell they want with these people, whether they're American citizens or not.
When the light is shined on the worst element of the Bush administration policy here, they changed the policy. It's like, you know, three-card Monty that you see out in the street somewhere. They just changed the policy a little bit. They say, oh, okay, we got 500 people in Guantanamo. We'll try 9 of them.
Right.
That means everything's okay. They wanted the Supreme Court, in fact, to stay out of this until after the trials took place.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So this is what's interesting, is by the time they finally hear this case, O'Connor is probably going to be gone. Alito will probably be in, and that guy always rules with the president, always rules with the government from his record.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why Hamdan's people are afraid that there will be a 4-4 deadlock in this case. And I believe, and I'm going to have to double check this, but I believe Ty doesn't go to the runner when the Supreme Court deadlocks 4-4 like this. I think they kind of like just throw it back.
Well, let me tell you, in just a couple minutes, I'm going to tell you there's big plans for a new multi-million dollar theme park. I think you'll be very surprised.
Oh, Lord.
To know where that theme park is going to be. A little later in the show, we're going to have best-selling author Roddy Doyle on. He's from the Commitments fame, if you saw that film. He's going to be in the studio. And also, it is Election Day.
Yeah.
So why don't you just go out and vote for Ferrer? Come on. Yeah, just so the guy doesn't have to feel like a complete schlub. Just go out there and vote for him. He's down like 38 points. Do the guy a favor.
He's not going to end up losing by 38 points. That was just a Pollyannish number, I think, that last poll did. But you never know.
Let's say 30.
Okay, 30. 20 would be a triumph at this point.
Well, you know, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, just because it seems like it's over for Freddie. Yeah, Freddie needs a little love, too. Don't sit at home and not do it. Don't not go vote. Go vote anyways, just so the guy doesn't have to feel too downhearted about this. He did try. He's still out there shaking hands and campaigning. I don't know if it had anything to do with that ridiculous Dancing Sharpton ad. But
that was a great ad, man. That, he looked like Jackie Gleason. I'm telling you.
I know. I guess. I mean, it was kind of funny to see him there. I didn't know how to feel exactly.
What was the bus doing there? That's what I'm trying to
say. It was like, Al, what are you? Of course you're doing that, but why?
Light on his feet.
Yeah. All right, so I'll tell you about the theme park in just a second and one of the Cliff Notes as well. It's 57 past. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Blah, blah, blah. It's 6 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm back. I was away for a long weekend up in Boston trying to recapture some of my past, maybe break some of the spells, see some colors. It was beautiful up there. I really had a nice drive. I rented a car, Riley, and drove all the way up to Newburyport, and it's peak leave turning time. I don't think I've ever seen it like this before. I want to, since I haven't been here since last Thursday, I want to thank everybody who came down to the live show and supported Morning Sedition. We had a great show. We had a great time. Interesting thing happened with Mark Crispin Miller made a statement on our show about an interaction he had with John Kerry. That John Kerry had told him that he believed there was election fraud, and then he publicly denied it through a spokesperson because Miller brought it up in public, and John Kerry's spokesperson said John Kerry never said that, and now it's sort of one of those things where it's who's telling the truth. I'll explain it to you a little more in just a little while. I also want to say to those of you who've been writing in and everything, thank you so much for the support, the petitions, and all the letters. I think they maybe they're helping. I don't know. Here are the options. Here's what's going to happen. I'm only going to say this once this week because I don't want to get too involved with this because it's too selfish. But here's what's going to happen. Either I'm going to stay here until the end of my contract, that is December 1st, or I'm going to stay a couple weeks longer than that to help ease the way into whatever they're planning next. Or I will say something stupid and be taken off the air. Those are bottom line what could happen. The idea that I'm going to be able to keep the show, that's starting to fade a bit. But those are the three options, so look forward to that. Either I'll be here till the December 1st, or I'll be here till December 15th, or I'll say something stupid and get pulled off the air. Why don't we vote on that? Why don't you email me and tell me what you should do, for what I should do. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning's Edition Cliff Notes. On this day, 11 years ago in 1994, Republicans won control of the House and the Senate. Gingrich united the GOP under the Contract with America, a 10-point legislative program to reduce federal taxes, balance the budget, and dismantle social welfare programs. 11 years later, the Republican Party is about to be dismantled by an unbalanced budget and a 5-point program of indictments. to commemorate this day in history, President Bush said it's time for the GOP to make another contract for America, one that is no bid and awarded to Halliburton. Pete Rose Jr., son of baseball's all-time hits leader, has pleaded guilty to distributing the performance-enhancing drug GBL to teammates. According to his father, Pete Rose, the line on his son being convicted is 5-1. Rose Jr. sold so many doses of the drug, he was known as the all-time GBL hit leader in the minor leagues. Iraq is hoping to become a major tourist destination with plans for theme parks and a 5-star hotel. The planned hotel will have the usual accoutrements, plush suites, business centers, and a kiosk in the foyer where customers can get their stumps polished. That was a rough one, and I knew it was a rough one, but I think it was poignant because it's probably true. And I think that's something you don't hear about in terms of talking about Iraq, to shift gears, is just how many people, civilians have been injured or hurt. And that's the type of stuff you see after a war, certainly one that's gone on for as long as this one has. I did mention briefly there that about the Republican Party, but 83 years ago today, Nazi forces surrounded a German beer hall where Bavarian government officials were meeting with local business leaders. Adolf Hitler burst into that room with a group of stormtroopers, shot off his pistol, and declared that the National Revolution had begun. 3 days later, he was busted, put in jail, where he wrote Mein Kampf and learned how to yell in a very compelling way. Now, 11 years ago today, the Republican Party won control of the Senate and the House of Representatives. Coincidence? You be the judge. That ended 60 years of mostly Democratic rule. No arrests were made, but that's still pending. We're looking forward to some of the arrests being made shortly in relation to Republican rule. Now, let's talk about Election Day a little bit, Mark Riley.
Yeah.
Farrar and Bloomberg here is that's
supposed to be no contest.
It seems like it's going to be no contest. But let's talk about some of these other elections, if we could, because when you have local elections, when you have gubernatorial races and whatever races are going on in terms of propositions and referendums, or not referendums, but propositions in terms of changing existing laws, the nation will see how many voters have either changed their attitudes or stayed the same in terms of what went on in the 2004 elections on issues like same-sex marriage, abortion, the death penalty, state taxes. There are elections in Texas, California, Virginia, all across the country. In Virginia, you've got this guy, a Republican candidate for governor, Jerry Kilgore.
Kilgore, yeah.
Is using the death penalty as his main rallying point against his Democratic opponent, Tim Kaine, who is against the death penalty. But this is the weird thing about Democrats. He's against the death penalty, but because it's okay to sentence people to death in Virginia,
yeah,
he's saying, I'm against it, but if the jury say do it, you got to do it.
Well, yeah, he's essentially saying the same kind of thing that you're going to hear our Supreme Court nominee Alito say when he gets in front of the Judiciary Committee, and that is, it's the law, therefore I will vote to uphold the law. Now, what this guy is saying is that because Virginia is an execution-happy state, I mean, they're right alongside of Texas.
They've murdered more murderers than any other state but Texas.
But Texas. Yeah. Yeah. So Tim Kaine is saying, well, if I'm governor and that is the law, then I will uphold the law. But the big reason why everyone's watching Virginia more, unlike New Jersey,
yes,
where Doug Forrester has not really called on George W. Bush to go out and stump for him, for obvious reasons, Kilgore in Virginia has. Bush has been on the stump with Kilgore as recently as this past weekend, trying to get particularly the voters in the more rural areas of Western Virginia, as opposed to the suburbs of Washington, D.C., which are generally perceived to be solidly Democratic. So now the Virginia race is going to be a serious test of whether George W. Bush has any coattails whatsoever in a statewide race.
Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting when Republicans start doing that, but apparently John Corzine ran some ads saying, like, you want to be associated with this
Bush,
guy?
Yeah.
That's pretty profound that that guy stinks that much. And I think it's very encouraging to the Democratic cause. Now, if we can get a platform together that isn't just, hey, at least we're not them, vote for us.
Yeah.
If that actually happens, then maybe we can get some momentum off of this. I guess in Colorado, which is a state that's been dominated by Republicans since the Republicans took over in 1994, there was some hope in last Tuesday's elections around a taxpayer's bill of rights. This apparently was enacted in 92. And what
Tabor,
which put a cap on state spending, and whatever was over that was sent back to taxpayers. But now the cap is not going to be as solid, and the state can hold on to a little of that money and perhaps put it into schools or into infrastructure rebuilding, into some of the things that are important to the community, which is more of a democratic set of values as opposed to just getting the money back and keeping it for me.
Well, what they're doing, see, when you have this kind of cap on state spending, the implication is that you will have to cut programs in order to stay under the cap. It's the same kind of thing that they do in professional sports.
Got it.
Now, what has happened is Colorado voters have essentially said, you know what, this is hurting us. It's hurting our schools. It's hurting our health care. It's hurting the things that taxpayers actually pay for. So therefore, we need to lift the cap so the government can go out and spend money that the state needs to spend.
Interesting. So these are a group of voters. These are taxpayers saying that we pay taxes for these reasons, to maintain our communities, to keep the state healthy, to keep social programs alive, to help out people who are less fortunate than us. And that's why we do our civic duty and pay our taxes, and we'd like them to be used that way, if that's okay.
Well, yeah, and see,
wow, that'd be amazing if people in this country thought that way.
Well, you know what? People in the country actually did think that way. Let's go back to something you mentioned earlier, the Republican Revolution and the contract with America in 1994.
Okay.
One of the reasons why it didn't happen was because in 1995, when Newt Gingrich and them decided to shut down the government, people started realizing, wait a minute, the taxes that we pay actually come back to us in the form of checks that we get from the government for various and sundry reasons, and suddenly those checks stopped, and people said, you know what? There's a problem here. It is not just about the government soaking up all your money. The fact is they give you some of the money back anyway.
Right. Now, you're in California, that state will vote on a few propositions. One will prohibit abortions for a minor until 48 hours after her physician notifies her parent or legal guardian, except in a medical emergency. Another proposition would increase the length of time it would take for a public school teacher to get tenure from 2 to 5 years. One is going to curb contributions by public employee labor unions, forcing union leaders to get prior written consent for members for their dues money to be used for political purposes. That seems decent. One would take congressional redistricting out of the hands of the state legislator and put the responsibility in the hands of a panel of retired judges. And apparently Ohio is going to be doing a similar thing on that. So this is interesting stuff. Now, did you find out, Riley, where Schwarzenegger stands on this abortion thing?
Now, it's interesting. As recently as mid-September, he said he approved of it in principle, but he did not specifically endorse it.
Mm-hmm.
So he may have changed his mind since then, but this was a very sensitive issue for him. This is, some people are regarding this whole referendum and all of these ballot initiatives as a power grab on the part of Governor Schwarzenegger to try and take, for example, the idea of the state budget out of the hands of a democratically controlled state legislature, and to take some power away from unions who oft times will lobby legislators against some of Schwarzenegger's initiatives.
Okay, so I guess we'll see what happens with that. Texas is going to vote on a same-sex marriage ban. I think we can pretty much assume they're going to vote on a same-sex marriage ban. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, we were talking about Colorado before. You know, one of the things they did last Tuesday was the city of Denver decriminalized marijuana last Tuesday. in an open referendum. Now, that doesn't mean that you can go smoking a spliff down the middle of whatever block it is in Denver, because state law can still be enforced. But the fact is, the city of Denver became one of the first major American cities to decriminalize marijuana.
All for all of it, that it's not, there's no weight limitation on it. Is it under an ounce? Is it a joint? I mean, usually when it's decriminalized, it's usually if you don't have a pound. Like, you can't have a backpack full of reefer on you in Denver and say, dude, I was just going to cross
personal
town.
Personal use. It's a small amount. It's not the pound.
Well, that's good. That means that people aren't going to go to jail for a year or five for having a couple of joints on them, you know?
Yeah. Thank God. This would, by the way, be for people over the age of 21, they could possess up to an ounce.
See, did you hear that, little Goliath? So when you go to...
When you go to
Colorado...
Stereotyping the big guys.
Dude, let me tell you something. If there's one thing I miss more than just about anything in my past, it's pot. Because to me, pot was great for breakfast. It was great for going to the movies. It was great for a rainy day or a sunny day. It was great just to have dinner. Man, it was
or
good
two.
For so many things.
Yeah. Or a gallon of ice cream.
Well, I can do that on my own now. I find that depression and anxiety propels me to the pint as well, the pint of ice cream. But anyways, 18 past the hour, we're going to have Roddy Doyle with the commitments in a few minutes. And also, we're going to tell you whether or not you should be afraid of bird flu. Kind of. I'm a little nervous. I feel under the weather. Do I look sick? And also the Iraq theme park coming up. 18 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Is it possible for you to shut the f*** up for 10 seconds?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. That music you hear is the sound of the commitments. We're going to be talking to best-selling author Roddy Doyle, who wrote The Commitments and The Snapper. He's going to join us to talk about his latest novel called Oh, Play That Thing in just a few minutes. Some other news here. A $100 million five-star, 23-story building is being erected in the center of what will be a projected theme park that will have plush suites, business centers, conference halls, a golf course, and it's in Iraq. Four! Iraqi tourists aboard the Iraqi Tourist Board Commission is looking ahead. The structure will be in the green zone. It's going to be as fortified as well as possible against rocket-launched grenades. There is a plan to turn Saddam's old palaces in Tikrit into themed tourist destination. Although the investors' names are being withheld for security reasons, we actually were able to find out details about some of the features at the new Iraq theme parks and hotels. For instance, they have one ride where you dodge around exploding obstacles. It's called the parking lot. there's an area in the park where democracy has taken hold without any further fatalities. That would, of course, be fantasy land. Also, in their version of It's a Small World, the company that builds everything in the park just happens to have been run by the vice president of the United States. then, of course, you got Mr. Bush's Wild Ride, which is a 5-minute ride that ends up lasting 2 years and costing 2,000 American soldiers their lives. And it's a punchline, but no, it's too heavy for Kalo. It's really, that's just too much. And you can see the promise of the future die in the Tomorrowland Never Comes ride. Here's some other rides and attractions at the Iraq theme park. You've got the Disney's Lights That Never Go On parade. And How about Insurgents of the Sunni Triangle? Anything? There you go. This one's going to be very popular. Exploding bumper cars, people. Oh. Then, of course, you have the never-ending tour of duty ride. Yeah. Okay. How about Dumbo the Hijacked Flying Elephant? Anything? Dumbo the Hijacked Flying Elephant. Back to the Future, American Occupation. How about that? And, of course, it's a small world invaded. It's a small invaded world full of oil. Yeah. Oh, you know, maybe it's my tone. Maybe I'm not as peppy as I should be. I have relaxed for a few days, and maybe my heart's too close to my the surface. Is that what's going on, Kalo? Can you feel it? Can you feel a slight pain in my voice, Kalo?
I can feel something.
You can?
Yeah. I don't think it has anything to do with you. What he's feeling?
No, really. What do you got on the screen there for a change? What do you look? See, that's what I miss about the old studio. It's like, what's Kalo looking at? You drinking that pomegranate juice?
I'm drinking pomegranate juice, and it cost me $5.
And you know what it is? That is the most concentrated liquid sugar you will ever drink in your life, but it's supposed to have detoxifying qualities.
So what does that mean?
I don't know what the hell it means.
Get rid of free radicals or something?
Free radicals. In your system. And when there's little weird malignant cells in your stream going, let's take it over! They die when you drink the pomegranate juice.
Yeah. Do I drink it every day or like once a month?
Man. You know, if that's what it tells you, why don't you do it? And I'll put you in touch with my dad. I'll hook you up with some supplements.
Oh, my God. In Bay Ridge, I saw someone with your dad's shoes.
Oh, you saw someone with the easy, what is it, Z-coil?
Z-coil.
He sent me a pair to run in, but I'm so afraid of how people are going to look at me at the
gym. Like Inspector Gadget shoes.
I know. They've got the little spring on the heel, and I'm afraid to go running in them because not only am I afraid I'm going to fall down, but I'm afraid people are going to look at me and think, well, that's sad. I wonder what happened to his feet. You know, it's supposed to be great. I mean, Nike makes one, but at least they make the springs look cool. You know what I mean? Is that Faith No More here in my ear?
Yeah.
Is that signifying the time to ease out into the next thing? Of course it is. We're going to have Roddy Doyle from The Commitments fame. He's going to join us in the studio in just a second to talk about his new book and to talk about music and, you know, whatnot. Should be good, right, fellas? All right, hang out for that. 27 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Good morning, folks. It's Tuesday. I hope you're having a decent go of it already this morning. I'm starting to feel better. I wasn't feeling great when I got here, but I feel better now, Mark.
You feel better?
It's nice seeing you.
It's good seeing you, man.
The fellas being away for 4 days. I've been uplifted. Our next guest is a best-selling Irish author and a Booker Prize winner, but he's perhaps best known for The Commitments, his novel-turned-film about the world's hardest-working band and their efforts to bring soul music to Ireland. His latest book, Oh Play That Thing, is his first set out of Ireland and released late last month in paperback. Roddy Doyle joins us live in studio this morning. Good morning, Roddy.
Hello.
Good morning. So this is this part of a series of books? Yeah, I'm not as familiar with you as I should be, but I know that our booker, who is Irish, is like, oh my God, he's the biggest thing. Now, how many books have you written, and is this new one part of a series?
I've written 8 so far for adults, and I write for children as well. I've written 3 books for kids, but it is going to be, I hope, it's the second volume of what I hope will be 3. I haven't started the third volume yet.
And your protagonist is Henry Smart.
His name is Henry Smart. He was born in 1901, and he becomes embroiled in the Irish War of Independence. And the first volume is about that stage of his life. The second volume, at the end of the first, inevitably after the War of Independence there's the Civil War, and he's on the wrong side of both sides, you know what I mean?
So
his choice is to get out of Ireland or die, so he leaves. And the second volume, Oh Play That Thing, he comes, like millions of other Irish people, to America in 1924.
And what does he land in New York?
He lands in New York. I wanted him to go through Ellis Island.
Sure.
I think largely because of Godfather 2 and that scene where Corleone goes through Ellis Island, and I suppose the whole history of Ellis Island. And Ellis Island in that way stopped being used in that way, I think, in September 1924.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was writing fiction, so I could have kept it open for another couple of months. But for some reason, I decided he had to arrive before they shut it. So he arrives in 1924 through Ellis Island and spends his first months in on Manhattan.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did he make his way once he got here? What did he do?
Well, a lot of the inspiration came from photographs. And there was an old Samuel Fuller, the film director.
Sam Fuller, yeah.
Sam Fuller was He had there's a small collection of photographs that he took in the 30s. And I saw a photograph of a sandwich board man looking quite forlorn and miserable on the side of the street.
Yeah.
And Henry is the type of character who would take the sandwich boards and make an art form out of it almost. So he decided that if you put a sort of a good-looking man with good shoulders between the sandwich boards and made him parade up and down, it would be a very effective way of advertising, more so than just the words on the boards. So after accepting and rejecting jobs that don't... He does reading. He's a lector in a cigar factory as well up in the...
Oh, okay. Now, I know a little bit about this. In the old days, in cigar factories, they had people who would sit up over the top of all of these people working rolling cigars, and they would read to them as a way to alleviate boredom. That
they
was
still
true.
They still do
that. Yeah, they do it in Cuba. I know that.
That's interesting. So that is some sort of tradition in cigar factories?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, newspapers in the morning, fiction in the afternoon.
Sometimes musicians. They didn't have TV back then.
They should do that in more places. How come you don't hear that more? Maybe that would keep people offline at work.
Because I suppose in most factories, if you have that, you're going to lose an arm or a leg.
If you're just sitting there rolling cigars, it's no big deal.
A three-wheeled car.
Yeah, if you're working the circular saw, you don't want to go, what?
Exactly.
Okay.
So anyway, he becomes a sandwich board man. He thinks he's reached. He thinks he's arrived at a new world, but of course it's all been carved out before he arrives. So, what he thinks are his streets aren't his streets, and people want a slice of the action, so he has to run.
Okay. Now, in throughout the narrative of the book, I know that you like to involve him in real history. You have a certain dedication, as you just said, just in terms of Ellis Island. Uh-huh. You didn't want to fictionalize when it closed.
Yeah.
This character comes in contact with a lot of historical figures.
Yeah.
How does that transpire? I mean, when he, because I know from reading some of the materials about it that he meets John Ford, that he meets Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
And what are some of the stories revolving around that?
Well, the Armstrong thing. It seems a strange thing to send an Irish rebel to Ireland, and he ends up being friendly with Louis Armstrong, but. It was, like a lot of decisions in fiction, it was quite a whimsical thing, really. I was reading a review of a new biography of Armstrong.
Yeah.
About 7 or 8 years ago. And it included a story, I won't use the word that was in the story, but when he was leaving New Orleans when he was about 20 and going up to Chicago to eventually become the world famous figure, a bouncer in a club down there said, Louis, if you're going to make it up there, find yourself a white man who'll put his hand on your shoulder and say, this here is my black man. But he didn't say black man, he said the more offensive word. And that story just, it jumped up off the page and hit me on the face.
Uh-huh.
I just thought it was an awful lot. There's an awful lot about race, the precarious nature of music, the precarious nature of the black musician in a white world. All these things, they were just jumping up and down. And I thought, and again, the whimsical decision, I thought, well, what if Henry could be that white man?
And you have the freedom to do that.
I did. There are, I suppose there are issues. Being a kind of a wet liberal from Ireland, I was wondering, am I, and white, this morning extremely white, am I entitled to do this?
You know,
and because he was a real person after all, and yes, I am. Tolstoy did it.
Sure.
He really did have Joe Glazer, who was his manager.
Yes, he did,
manager until Glazer died.
Yeah, he eventually had Glazer.
In the early 30s, I think.
Yeah, but he was... What I liked, as I began to read deeper into Armstrong, I loved it. He knew what he had, and he wanted control of what he had.
Of what he had, sure.
So I thought, well, if Henry can, I thought there'd be an interesting story there. And I also love writing about music. Most of my novels are full of song lyrics and things like that. I'm never far from it. I listen to it when I'm working. So it just seemed too attractive an option. I was always open to the idea, well, I can't get there. But then I read very early on that Armstrong bought a typewriter when he was young and carried it everywhere he went for the rest of his life. And it was all, there was a card table and the typewriter in his dressing room. I suspect one of the reasons he had the typewriter was because it gave him a polite excuse to turn his back and have time for himself, because he was always surrounded,
you
can imagine. So he typed out thousands of letters to people. He wrote a memoir of his childhood in New Orleans, which would make particularly good reading now, bearing in mind what happened there recently. And it was assumed for years that because he was an unschooled black man, that it had been ghostwritten by some white guy with a goatee beard, but he wrote it. So as I got deeper into it, I began to take down words that he seemed to use quite a lot. And I suppose fooled myself into thinking that I could give him some sort of life.
You mean that in by doing the research and becoming, it seems, somewhat obsessed with Louis Armstrong for a period of time, you were able to characterize him in your book with a certain amount of respect?
There was one afternoon in 2001 where I was, for 2 hours, Ireland's foremost expert on him.
I think I heard that. We're talking to Roddy Doyle. His new book is Oh, Play That Thing. Now, talk to... There's a lot that has been said about the Irish spirit, and certainly the Irish spirit when Irish people moved to America. How do you characterize that for yourself?
I wasn't over interested in it, to be honest with you, because what Henry is trying to do when he gets out of Ireland, he's following a lot of people, you know, but his circumstances are somewhat different in that he's getting out because he's going to be shot. And what he wants to do is to stay away from Ireland and all things Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks he's coming to a very big country with lots of space, so he thinks he can do this. And like a lot of people, reinvent himself, give himself a new name. And he's running away from what he has done. He's been involved in creating what became the Irish state. I'll give you an example. My father's uncle in 1914 mm-hmm. joined what was then the army.
Yeah.
He went off and fought these battles in Turkey and other places. He survived, luckily, came back in 1918, and he was in the British army. He went off a hero, and 4 years later he came back something of a traitor.
Yeah.
He was on the wrong side.
Right.
And Henry is in there somewhere in 1916, helping with very few other people define what I take for granted as the Irish state. And he runs away from that. And I keep him away from what I suppose you would think of as Irish communities, because he doesn't want to go there. And he, you know, stupidly, I suppose, he goes to Chicago, but he thinks, well, there's lots of elbow room here, and that he can avoid all things Irish. But I suppose, it's an impossibility. Well, I find it an impossibility, because I could be talking to somebody who looks solidly Asian, and they'll tell me, oh, I'm Irish.
Only in America, right?
Only in America, yeah.
Roddy Doyle, Henry had a confrontation with the mob here in New York when he settled, because he was, in addition to wearing a sandwich board, apparently selling bootleg hooch underneath it.
Hidden inside.
Yeah. Now, when he goes to Chicago, it's pretty well known that Armstrong also had a bit of a relationship with the mob. There are all kinds of urban myths about his being Al Capone's favorite trumpet player and getting locked into a gig that he couldn't get out of because the guy who owned the club was a mobster. How did Henry deal with Armstrong and the mob in Chicago in your novel?
They got out of Chicago.
Start running.
A lot of the musicians were enslaved to their clubs, and the clubs were owned by the mob, you know. And even somebody as revered and as vital to American culture as Ellington, when he wanted to go somewhere else than the Cotton Club, he had to organize somebody to come in, say Cab Calloway or somebody like that.
Yeah.
But he was, Ellington, I suppose, being an extremely bright man, knew that he had to play the game, you know.
Because only Madden owned the Cotton Club.
Yeah,
and
there were stories of lesser-known musicians who were, you know, basically maimed because they wouldn't play ball, you know. Mm-hmm. They'd have fingers broken, and a musician's fingers are obviously even more vital than ours. Mm-hmm. So, and Armstrong wanted to be, you know, for want of a better cliche, to be his own man, you know. They're not particularly, Henry isn't particularly successful. He doesn't try to take on the mob. There's too many of them. But the temporary solution is for them to run. Now, Armstrong did leave Chicago.
Went to New York.
And became, I suppose by today's standards, a pop star.
Yeah. You know? So it's good, though, when characters have to leave, because then you go to a new place.
I live in Dublin, you know. Yeah. I have to go to Chicago. And the sad thing about going to Chicago was that of all the buildings that housed jazz clubs in the 1920s, you know, down in Bronzeville, mm-hmm. there's only one building now standing. Everything else has been knocked down, road widening, etc., you know. And there's only one. It's a hardware store.
Yeah.
And all the other buildings are gone.
Yeah.
Now, I'd come a long way and I saw that, and that was quite disappointing. It's a bit like going to China to see the wall and they've knocked it down to make a freeway or something.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, as a novelist, I found it quite liberating, because all those streets had been demolished, all these clubs had been demolished, so I could fall back on, say, the movie The Cotton Club and look at
You could invent them yourself, too.
I could invent them myself. So it was in from that regard, it made it easier for me working in a room in Dublin to write about a place that really doesn't exist.
Yeah, and you can't play to the one guy that's going, I was at that place, the lamps were different.
Yeah, he's always going to be there. He follows me all over the world.
He lives in your head, my friend.
I am he.
So now, you know, before we go, you want to talk a little bit about the children's books? Cause I know you mentioned that at the beginning of our conversation here. That must be fun to write for kids.
Yeah, I didn't particularly want to talk about them, but yeah.
We don't have to.
I do. I suppose... I became well known initially for my first book, The Commitments, and it's a comic novel, you know, and the movie I would hope makes people feel good.
It's a good movie, uplifting.
And then later on, I began to write about alcoholism and domestic violence and things like that. And I'm the same person as I was. I suppose I'm older and wiser and less hair. But the children's books, as I began to write them for my own kids, I found them quite. Again, I think I probably used the word liberating early on, but it was because I could use the comedy that was there in the back of my head, and I couldn't really use for a lot of adult work.
Nice, simple comedy.
Yeah, and it's touches of Monty Python.
Good.
You know, it's about a family. There's the father is Mr. Mac, mm-hmm. and his wife is called Billie Jean Fleetwood Mac. So there's touches in there. Now, the kids like the rhythm of the name, but the name is in there for their parents, if you know what I mean.
Well, now I'm gonna have to have some kids so I can read them to the kids when they come out.
There's a point, yeah. I'm not sure if it works, though.
I'll get to work on that. Roddy Doyle, thank you so much. It was great talking to you. The new book is Oh, Play That Thing. It sounds like it's got a film script written all over it in terms of the history.
Well, not really.
I misuse that word again, the history.
I think there's always a lot of interest in making a biopic of Louis Armstrong's life, but I can't claim copyright to that.
Sure.
So that's the limitations of its movie possibilities. And it's important as a writer that when I am writing a novel, I just write the novel and I don't think about, you know, the possibility of movies or things like that because it would spoil the writing, I suspect.
Absolutely.
So far, there's been absolutely no interest in it as a movie.
Well, I'm interested in it as a movie.
Fine, I'll talk to you later.
Okay, good. Roddy Doyle, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to, in just a couple minutes, we'll have the job listing coming up and I'm going to talk about the little battle that's going on between Mark Crispin Miller and John Kerry that started on our show. 48 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, here to remind you that when top news reporters and investigative journalists like me want their news skewed so far to the left it's wearing a dress, we turn to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 53 past the hour. Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. But now I'm sitting here paranoid. I had Roddy Doyle in here. All right, we're talking to him. And the whole time, I'm thinking about this joke that someone told me, about this Irish joke someone told me. And you can't even tell a joke if it's about any sort of ethnicity without one. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, I want to tell him the joke through the whole interview because I think it characterizes what I thought to be the Irish spirit in America, you know, at the beginning when they immigrated here. And then I told him the joke, and I don't know if he responded well or not.
He laughed.
The joke is, I mean, tell me if this is somehow, I don't know, would it be racist? Look, here's the joke. A couple of Irish guys immigrate to the United States. It's in the 1800s. They can't find work in New York. A bartender says, look, you got to go out west and scalp some Indians. They're paying $1 a scalp out west for Indian scalps. So these guys go. So they go out, they get a coach, they go out into the middle of the west, they get some horses, and they ride out into Indian country to get themselves some Indian scalps. And they get to a ridge and they're literally surrounded by about 1,000 Indians. And one of them looks at the other and says, we're going to be rich. But in my head, that does not mean stupid. That means, without a doubt. The
indomitable spirit of the Irish.
Exactly, Brendan McDonald.
There you go.
So, yeah. But you got it, right? Do I have time for this?
I like it. You have time for everything.
We know things are tough in the job market right now, so we've decided to help out. I just happened to be scanning the want ads, and this posting caught my attention for our Morning Sedition Tuesday job listing. All right, here we go. Morning talk show host. Hey, what a coincidence. I might be in the market for that kind of job soon. Let's see what it says. Left-leaning talk radio network seeks a new host for morning drive time show. Wow, that's exactly what I do. Maybe I should contact these people. Our ideal host will be non-threatening and not judgmental. Uh-oh. Now these people sound like total idiots. All right. We're looking for someone who can present pre-written pieces without making snide editorial comments. Yeah, wow, it sounds like you're looking for a trained chimp, buddy. All right. Must be able to deal with typographic errors on the fly. On the fly? What the hell is the fly? What does that mean? We need a host who can conduct a show with dignity and maturity. Well, I got one thing to say about that. Most importantly, we are looking for someone with an acute awareness of what is going on, an ability to immediately clue in. In short, someone who can take a hint. Well, wow, that's me to a T. Now I'm intrigued again. Paranoid over-analytical ties need not apply. Hey, they're talking about me. Or they just want me to think that. What the hell's going on here? One more important qualification. The ideal candidate won't be you, Mark. All right. Well, that seals it. I'm applying. I'm in, man. So this is going to be interesting, isn't it? Do we have interesting things coming up? I'm looking forward to. David Cronenberg's going to be here tomorrow. How do you like that? And I hope I'm here on a day-to-day basis. It's going to be very hard to manage my spite and resentment and my extreme deep desire, Mark Riley, to sabotage myself. So you just hang out over there and let's see if one morning I just melt down.
No, it won't happen. Won't happen.
They just keep pushing that dump button. They're like, we're out of dump time. And then I shut down the network. Wouldn't that be a great day? All right. What am I going to do? Oh, I wanted to tell you about John Kerry. We had Mark Crispin Miller on our show last Thursday,
yep.
Who said he had spoken directly to John Kerry at a book event, and John Kerry had told him that the election was stolen. And then when Mark Crispin Miller said that on our show, John Kerry's spokesperson came out and denied it. So there's a little feud going on. I'll give you the details in a second. 57 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's 6 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It is election day. Go out and do your civic duty and vote for somebody you like or somebody that appeals to you or somebody that actually might do something. Why don't you try that one, voting for somebody who might do something. But it's hard to know, isn't it, Riley, because they all say they're going to do something.
They all say they're going to do something.
And they got their big plans and their big ideas. It's pretty clear that Ferrer, in one poll, was down by 38 points.
That's in the race against Michael Bloomberg for the mayoralty of New York City.
And the Corzine race in New Jersey is tight and got very ugly over the last few days. Yes. We'll see what happens. There are a lot of elections going on around the country that will shed some light as to whether or not people, their attitudes around certain issues are changing. There are elections in Texas and California and in Virginia that will shed some light on things like capital punishment, on things like the abortion issue, same-sex marriages. So we should really be able to tell a little bit, at least in the week to come, as to whether or not things are changing as far as the tone of culture goes. Right now, I'd like to bring up something that happened on our show last Thursday at the live show. By the way, I haven't been back since that show. I'd like to thank everybody for coming down and supporting the show. That was great. I have very little to report to you other than as far as the progress of my future here at the show is concerned, other than I will either be here through the end of my contract on December 1st. If something else occurs, I might be here a couple weeks after that. And if I lose my mind, I might be yanked off the air at any given time. But hang on for that idea. Maybe that won't happen. I'm pretty sure it won't. But the idea that this show will stay intact is drifting away. Now, moving on. Mark Crispin Miller on my show last week, on Mark Riley's and my show last week at the live broadcast down there at O'Neill's, said this.
You know, by the way, yes. I saw him Friday night.
And how was that for you?
It was a very good meeting. He didn't say it was off the record.
He's talking about John Kerry.
I'm taking the liberty.
We're breaking news. Uh-oh.
We actually are breaking news.
What do you got?
Well, he thinks it was stolen, too.
Why didn't he do anything? Why didn't you do anything?
Well, just a second now. What, you mean a year ago, why didn't you do anything?
How about, like, right after?
Right after? Because he's surrounded by, imbecile. In the book, I have an anecdote. I talked to somebody who's close to John Edwards and who was with Edwards when Kerry called him on the cell to say, I'm pulling out. This is 4 hours after Edwards had said, we're going to count every vote. So Edwards was a little seamed by this. And Kerry was saying, nah, they're telling me I can't do it. I can't pull it out. And you know what else they're saying? They're saying that if I don't concede, they're going to call us sore losers.
Well, that was Mark Chrisman Miller on our show last Thursday, and a Kerry campaign spokesperson came out and said, quote, I know Mr. Miller is trying to sell his book, and he feels passionately about his thesis, but his recent statements about his conversation with Senator Kerry are simply not true. The only thing true about his recollection of the conversation is that he gave Senator Kerry a copy of his book. Now, Miller told Miller in response to that said, I call that contemptible. He told Raw Story this. He said that quote, that's completely false, unquote. Quote again from Miller, anyone who knows my work knows that I'm not much interested in commercial gain. I wrote Fooled Again out of a sense of civic obligation, and I thought the senator shared that concern with me, end quote. Now, I got to tell you something, Riley. I got to go with Miller on this one. I think he was telling the truth. I think that Kerry said, yes, I agree, the election was stolen, and that he didn't expect it to be brought out in public, and Miller did, and he said, put the spokesman out to say that it was untrue.
That would be an entirely credible scenario, Mark. I've seen it happen before where people say, you know, you're moving around, somebody gives you something, they say, hey, they stole the election, and yeah, you're right, you know, they did. But then when the time comes, you have people in your office, because he still is a standing United States senator, saying, what did you say? Why did you say that? You better issue a denial post haste.
And that's what happened. That's probably what happened. That makes complete sense to me. Let's talk torture for a minute. Given that the Senate passed legislation banning torture against the White House's opposition, and given the fact that Alberto Torquemada Gonzalez helped draft the new rules for the U.S. military that works around the Geneva Conventions, and of course, given the fact that the photos from Abu Ghraib, exist, the president saying this yesterday is completely hollow.
Gathering information about where the terrorists may be hiding, we are trying to disrupt their plots and plans. Anything we do to that end, any activity we conduct is within the law. We do not torture.
Now let's exactly. So now this is unbelievable to me, because you have the Senate that's voted unanimously almost in favor of this amendment to stop torture, yet you have a White House that's saying something like this. So if they really feel that way, Riley, why don't they just say, that's a great amendment, go ahead forward with that?
Because Dick Cheney has become fixated on ensuring that the president will have the power to allow torture, even as he says, we do not torture.
That's exactly right. And that's right. Dick Cheney is also, trying to put out there's new manuals being released.
Yeah.
Apparently, there's these new manuals, these new directives that are going to, say what the Pentagon considers torture, how to properly interrogate. And apparently the manuals even use the language of the Geneva Conventions in terms of cruel, humiliating, and degrading treatment. Now, the vice president's office wants those words to be taken out. He wants the language of the Geneva Convention to be struck from any of the U.S. related torture information, either directives to soldiers or anybody else, because he believes that this is efficient. He believes that it is proper to torture. He has all those secret prisons set up to torture.
Yep. And he says that as far as the CIA is concerned, anything goes.
And he wants to have that freedom.
He wants to have that freedom. But remember, well, we should put this in a context. We should put this in context for people. The same guy who says he wants to have the CIA free to do this sort of thing is the same guy who apparently played a central role in the outing of what? A CIA officer.
Right.
So whose side is he actually on here?
Well, I just think that it's completely goes, this is a clear indication of the two realities that we have to live with. We have to live with the reality they keep imposing on us information-wise and the reality that they're hiding, that is the neocon death cult reality, and also the desires of the American people to know the truth, to try to stop some of this this behavior that is making us not the laughingstock, but a beacon of resentment throughout the world. We're supposed to be a barometer of some integrity, at least on a legislative level, on a legal level, and on a behavioral level in terms of how we function out there in the world. Yet with stuff like this, we look like the evil bastards that we are, that we have a vice president that wants to protect his ability to torture people, even though he knows that it's a lie.
He is fighting here a Senate that voted 90-9. In favor of an amendment that was introduced by John McCain, who's someone who knows something about torture because he was tortured as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. And what he's saying is, we will not use torture, period. And for whatever sets of reasons, and I think it really has to do with a grab at power and secrecy on the part of this administration for future administrations to come, they simply will not unequivocally reject the use of torture.
It just seems to me that, you know, if there needs to be a reminder, you know, we can just, you know, take a look at the Abu Ghraib slideshow. That for the president to say that there isn't torture, that we don't torture, you know, it's, you know... All right, there's the guy with the dog growling about ready to chomp on his genitals. Oh, there's the guy on the floor who looks like he's crying on a leash, and Lindy England is laughing. Oh, there's that dead guy that they don't even know how he died. Oh, there's the pyramid of bodies. Oh, there's the guy in the box with the electrodes and the hood on. But, you know, but we don't torture because they bent the rules to make this okay. You're dealing with an administration that thinks anything up until death is just reasonable interrogation and questioning. Then after death, of course, it's the fault of an underling or a bad apple.
Yeah.
So, look, when we come back here in just a second, I believe that we're going to be talking to our international correspondent, Angus McFarker, I believe, is in France. So that should be a very revealing and in-depth report from Angus. Stick around for that. 15 past Air America Radio's Morning's Edition.
Morning's Edition on the air and online. Morning'sEdition.com. Air America Radio.
Twenty past the hour, I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Folks, earlier we heard from Newsweek Paris Bureau Chief Christopher Dickey about the ongoing crisis in France. And now with more on this story is Morning Sedition foreign correspondent Angus McFarker reporting from Paris. Hello, Angus. How are the conditions there right now?
Bonsoir, Mark. Well, I've got a wicked hangover, if that's what you mean. But I'll manage. Little hair of the dog will cure me, I reckon.
So, no, I mean the rioting. What's happening there with the rioting, Angus?
Oh, yes, of course, Mark. Well, French-born citizens of Arab or African origin are outraged by all the racism and unemployment, and so some kids in Toulouse set fire to a bus and 21 cars.
Oh, my God, that's just awful.
Yeah, and in Grigny, south of Paris, police were lured into a housing estate and attacked with pellet guns and rocks and petrol bombs.
Oh,
there's a lot of violence all over.
Right.
Also, one reporter was attacked, got a cracked rib, 3 chipped teeth and a concussion.
Oh, no. Did I hear something? Who was that?
That was me, Mark! Last night, right?
Yeah.
There were these 7 lads. Dark as an Arabian midnight, cornered me in a dark alley, and then completely and totally kicked my ass.
That's appalling, Angus. Are you okay, buddy?
I never felt better in my life.
Yeah, right.
Frankly, I didn't think the French had it in them.
Uh-huh.
World War II, bunch of Nazis and all that. But these North African lads, oh, they're really and truly pissed. They bludgeoned me with a viciousness and a lack of remorse that was truly impressive. Almost dare I say it. Scottish! Best riot of the year! Easily! 2 thumbs up!
Oh.
I've definitely got blood in my pee this morning, Mark! Really painful!
So wait, now
it hurts.
So you're enjoying this?
Enjoying it! it. I'm like a dog with the Christmas haggis.
Oh,
I haven't had this much fun since Scotland went to Italy to take on the bloody Itis in football. Maximum violence that weekend, I assure you. And these riots are right up there. Plus, since you're in Paris, there's access to a wide assortment of excellent wines and cheeses.
Uh-huh.
The Pinot Noirs are particularly lovely.
But come on, Angus, doesn't all the burning cars, doesn't that disturb you a little bit?
Well, of course it does, Mark. 2 days ago, I saw these Algerian lads standing around the car like they were going to torch it, yeah.
Yeah.
So I said, "Oi, Nancy, are you going to burn that car? Or are you going to stick your todger in it?" 30 seconds later, that car was a bonfire. Good fun, lads, the Algerians.
Oh, come on, that's disgusting. Don't you think you're just prolonging the violence there, Angus? You're not helping anything.
Well, as I always say, Mark, no violence, no story. A professional creates his own news.
Okay.
What have we got here? 3 lads throwing bricks.
All right.
And I don't think they're bricklayers. Oi, Nancy, throw that brick at me, huh?
All right, all right.
Throw on your pants.
Okay.
Ah, just sweet Angus McFarkin. Evu Wanker.
Okay.
Oh,
all right. Wait, Angus, come on, stop it. Angus, please. All right. That's. I guess we lost Angus.
Did he call somebody a wanker?
Oh, of course. You know, yeah, it's Angus, you know, creating the news as it happens. Let's talk about the bird flu because I'm feeling a little under the weather. The World Health Organization says it's only a matter of time, my friends, before we all die of the bird flu. All right, they didn't quite say it like that. The Food and Agricultural Organization said that the window of opportunity is now to nip it in the bud at the farm level. Now, bottom line, I guess, Riley, is that the virus hasn't mutated. You can only get it from a bird, but as soon as a human can get it from another human, that's when we're in trouble. Apparently, there needs to be a system in place to test and examine farm animals. There needs to be a system in place to reimburse the farmer for animals that need to be exterminated, or else the farmers will hide the chickens and not participate in the program. Now,
Hide the chickens and not participate in the program.
Well, apparently, if you're a farmer and you know that they're going to come around, I imagine this is happening a bit in China, you know they're going to come around and say, we got to test your chickens.
Okay.
Which is horrible when anyone says that to you, you know.
So
if they're going to test your chickens and you get a risk to lose, you know, half of your stock, you're going to want some guarantee that you're going to get them back. Now, apparently, there have been 63 deaths out of the 124 known cases of the bird flu. 150 million fowl have been slaughtered. The cost of the outbreak has been $10 billion so far. A pandemic could take 2-3% off the global economy and make some people really rich. Of course, pharmaceutical companies. A year of bird flu could cost the world about $800 billion. This is this all came down in Geneva. All this information came out of a Geneva confab that included the World Health Organization, the World Bank, the World Organization for Animal Health, and of course the organization that I just mentioned, which was the
the World Health Organization.
Yeah, I said the World Health Organization, but there was another more important organization that I also mentioned, and I'll find it in a minute. But it's getting kind of scary. But the interesting thing is now is what about food issues? Because chicken processors, all right, and food chains like KFC, like Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Purdue are freaking out because this bird flu is going to have a tremendous impact on this $50 billion a year industry. Apparently, it's already had a bit of an impact in China where the businesses lost 10-20% in annual sales based on the bird flu. Now, I've been to China, and it's a very weird thing to see, Riley, when you're in Beijing, is that all the signs are in the Chinese sign language. Yeah.
Except for the chicken joint.
All you see is the current Colonel's face in a KFC, just among all the Chinese lettering. But so this is going to be interesting to see how they sell it, because it is true that you cannot get it from eating cooked chicken. You will be disappointed eating cooked chicken because it doesn't taste like it's supposed to. Anyway.
Well, you know what's interesting about all of what you just said? It was all about finance.
Yes.
It was not an estimate of how many people might be killed, how many people might be sick. It was all in terms of how much it would cost. It would shave this much off the national economy. It would shave this much off the $50 billion a year chicken-eating industry in this country. It's all about the money, not necessarily all about the people.
Well, that's exactly right. The Food and Agricultural Organization was the organization I was looking for. Well, that happens same with mad cow disease. Is that thing has been completely under wraps, and this thing is completely public, and the chances of this thing dissipating, I think, are probably pretty good. But the way that the cattle industry or the beef industry has handled the mad cow thing is horrendous because it's so secretive, and we have to make assumptions. At least this thing is out in the open. I do think it is being overblown, but that's just my personal opinion.
Well, it's out in the open to the extent that the people who make money from chickens have it out in the open. I'm not sure they're telling us everything just yet.
Well, I feel a little nauseous. Again,
you don't even eat chicken, dude.
Yeah, I know, but I've got the three birds in the house that I use to send messages to my friends. You know how it goes. All right, it's 27 past the hour. We're going to talk to producer Lawrence Bender. He's going to join us on the phone from L.A. to discuss Innocent Voices. It's an interesting movie. It's endorsed by Amnesty International. It's about El Salvador, and we will talk about that with him in just a minute. 27 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Morning.
It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio for the time being. Dig it. Amnesty International estimates that at this moment, over 300,000 children are actively fighting in wars across the world. Our next guest is the producer of the film Innocent Voices, which tells the story of one such child, an 11-year-old boy growing up in El Salvador during the U.S.-sponsored civil war there in the 1980s. Lawrence Bender, also known for his work producing all of Quentin Tarantino's films, joins us by phone this morning. Good morning, Lawrence.
Morning.
Morning.
So do you think you could give us a sense of what the film is about? I watched most of it today, but I'd like you to describe it to our listeners.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. First of all, you know, it's interesting when I, you know, half my life is making movies, the other half of my life is political activism. Mm-hmm. So when I get the opportunity to sort of combine the two, it's a, it really feels like it's a gift. And, you know, one thing is when we watch the war on TV in Iraq, we watch the invasion, Fallujah, whatever.
Right.
We never really get to see the point of view of the family that we're affecting. We never get to see the war through the eyes of a kid and or his mother. And that's kind of what this movie's about.
The civilian victims.
It's the civilian victims, exactly. Who really is affected. Of course, our brave men and women on the front line are, of course, affected, and the people they're fighting are affected. But the real people that are affected are these are the people who are living there and what happens to them. And we really never think about that. And so what this movie is about is this wonderful little boy who's 11 years old, and at 12 in El Salvador, they put the kids in the army at 12, actually. And he has to sort of make this decision as he reaches 12 as to what he's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could just imagine, as you reached 12 or I reached 12, what we were thinking, certainly not about going to the army. And he actually runs off and joins the guerrillas, and him and his friends are caught, and they're all executed. And when it gets to him, his uncle Beto saves him, honestly, just in time. He gets away, and his mom gets him out of the country, and he grew up here in the United States.
So this is a true story, Lawrence Bender, and it's based on how did you come in contact? And who is this fellow that wrote this story?
Well, the guy, his name is Oscar Torres, and mm-hmm. he grew up and he wrote this screenplay about his childhood. He ran into the director, Luis Mendoki, when Luis was in Mexico, and he was on a film set, and he actually said, hello, sir, would you read my screenplay?
Old school.
Yeah. Old school way, and he actually read it, and Luis soon after gave it to me. It was just something, as you know, I said earlier, just something that just really made me feel compelled to want to do.
You know, it's interesting, Lawrence Bender, in watching the film, the scariest parts for me were when soldiers simply went into a village and started shooting. There's a scene at during the early part of the movie when Chava's mother had gone to work, and the kids are, you know, have to literally climb under a bed to escape all of this random gunfire. In your judgment, is it difficult to convey exactly, you know, through the eyes of an 11 or 12-year-old child, the political dynamic at work here?
Well, honestly, that's something we decided not to do. I mean, you could easily get very political in a movie like this, in this kind of subject matter. Of course, America backed this horrific war and a lot of these wars in Central America. But at the same time, you know, America gave, I mean, when this boy came here, he grew up here, and he became a person, a human being that sort of contributed to the world. So, you know, we intentionally did not sort of want to make this kind of very anti-America case. What instead we wanted to do is be sort of true to what this boy's story was, which is it didn't matter on whose side you were. In their homes, they're so thin, these walls, that the bullets would go through. And it didn't matter, as they say in the movie, it doesn't matter if it's a guerrilla or it's the government bullets. If we get killed by one of them, you know, it doesn't matter whose name the bullet is on.
Right.
And these kids, I mean, there's a scene in the movie that we had to take out just because for Tommy purposes, but it was a great scene. You know, sometimes these battles would go on for a couple of days, and these people would have to remain in their homes and not go out. And they'd literally be crawling on their hands and knees on the dirt floors, and they put pots and pans on their heads for helmets.
Ugh.
And it's sad but funny at the same time. You see the family, you know, crawling around with the pots and pans on their heads and like playing a game, and it's actually very funny. And you know, it's just some of the weirdest things go on you just never would think of during a war that people have to deal with.
Now, you, as producer of this film, it's been made for a little while. It's a beautiful movie. There's no reason that everyone shouldn't see a film like this because it elevates social consciousness and it's also a compelling film. But, you know, these kind of movies aren't seen as much as you would want them to see. What's the problems that you're facing in distribution and raising awareness about this?
Well, you know, most people want to see a movie with a hero that has, like, a meteor about to hit the Earth or Spider-Man.
Sure.
And, you know, this movie doesn't have those type of heroes. This movie has a much more intricate hero, you know, the kid, the mother, single mother raising a family in the middle of a war. So, you know, it's just much harder to get people to see these kind of movies. So, you know, we're doing things like we had a screen at the United Nations a few weeks ago with Amnesty and UNICEF. We have these wonderful Latino organizations around the country supporting the movie. We have a lot of faith-based organizations. It's a wonderful priest character who very actively helps to save the community in lots of different ways, a very positive image. So, you know, it's very much a grassroots, in an organized way to get people to see the movie. You just can't afford to pay the advertising dollars that you do for other big movies.
Sure. Let me tell people how to see it here. Our guest is Lawrence Bender. He's the producer of Innocent Voices. Innocent Voices is playing at Cinema Village here in New York City. That's at 22 East 12th Street and University Place, a great little theater. So now, what was the reaction? Now, you're in partnership with Amnesty in terms of making this thing work?
Well, Amnesty came on board. You know, they love movies like this because it's, you know, it's an issue, one of the issues that they deal with, of course, and this is, you know, child soldiers. And as you started to say earlier in the program, child soldiers are, you know, it's an issue all over the world, whether you're in, you know, Uganda or the Congo or
sure.
Down in Brazil. I mean, sorry, in Colombia. Anyway, they estimate hundreds and hundreds of thousands of children soldiers all over the world. So it's an issue that they've gotten involved with, and they helped get us to the United Nations, where they have an entire office of children in armed conflict. So yes, they've been very actively involved. A woman, Bonnie Abounza, with artists with Amnesty, has mm-hmm. been like our godmother in a sense, helping us.
Mm-hmm.
Lawrence Bender, I know you mentioned that Oscar Torres, who is the real life protagonist in this story, you know, got his screenplay to Luis Mandaki the old fashioned way. But what is he doing now? I mean, how has his life been in the States?
Well, it's been a very interesting. It's been very interesting for him since. I mean, it's a long process. You know, he got to the United States. He found his father who had left him. That didn't quite work out. He went to live with an uncle, I believe. But he got a formal education. And in the movie, there's a song called Casa de Carton. It's Cardboard House. It's a song sung by a group called Los Guaraguao. And he's heard this. These guys who sing the song in the movie. It's a song of hope for the people of El Salvador. It's an illegal song. They were not allowed to listen to it. You're taken away if you were listening to it. They came to sing in Los Angeles, and he went and he heard about it. So he went to see them, and he just went up to them afterwards and said, "You guys inspired me. You know, the reason why I'm alive." And he promised them that he was going to write a screenplay about them. And so the original screenplay that he showed Luis was a screenplay about this group. And Luis said to him, "Look, this is a great story, but the real story is about you." And that's the story that they developed. since then, Oscar has been all over the world with the movie, whether it's Berlin or Italy, all over the country. And he's been running into interesting people. People have been dealing with child soldier issues in Africa. And so because he's been that in that world himself and has come through it and has transformed it in a sense into a story. It's sort of what he's been doing lately.
So, okay, well, again, the film is Innocent Voices. Our guest is Lawrence Bender. He's the producer. It's playing here in New York at the Cinema Village at 22 East 12th Street. It's a great little theater. Before we let you go, I gotta ask you, you produced some of those great Tarantino movies, and I've heard that you guys aren't working together anymore. What happened?
we've been friends for a long time, and we still are, and we've had a good long run of movies, and sometimes you grow apart, but he's still a good friend of mine, and so you just never know what's going to happen.
Well, I have noticed that perhaps since this relationship has changed, I haven't seen a Tarantino movie lately.
Oh, I'm sure he's working on something, and I don't quite know what, but I think he's, as usual, works really hard, and then takes a little bit of time off to live life. You know, when you make a movie, you're sort of living a different life, and you don't really get to live your normal life. So he likes to sort of take a little time off and live his life, and then sort of figure out what he's going to do next.
You should try morning radio if you don't want to live a normal life.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, so, tell me about it.
Yeah,
I'm up at 5:30 here on the West Coast.
How does that feel?
Well,
guess what? We're calling you tomorrow. So Lawrence Bender, what do you got in the works now after Innocent Voices? What are you producing?
Well, I'm actually producing a bunch of things, but one of the things I'm incredibly excited about is I'm doing a documentary with Al Gore on global warming, and that is going to be, that's just going to change the world. That's such an extraordinary thing that we're doing, and as you probably know, global warming is such a massive, massive issue.
I've heard that.
Yes. And,
we've mentioned it once or twice here on the network.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. But Al Gore is... he is so extraordinary. He is.
Could you tell him to run for president, please?
You know what? I think if enough people, say that to him, I think he will.
I do too.
I think he needs to hear that from a lot of people, and we'll pull him kicking and screaming.
So more specifically, are you working on any films that might be able to use a comedic talent that has about a year and a half's experience in radio that might be out of work soon?
Does he have a first name that starts with M and ends in K?
That's
me.
I got the C one. I'm Mark with a C.
Oh,
and you can contact my management. I'm a stand up comic, and I'm ready to go. I can do serious too.
You got me laughing right now.
Yeah, I could do serious. I'd like an opportunity to work with guns. Can I? Do you have anything like that?
You know, I don't really make movies with guns.
Really?
What would make you think I made movies with guns?
All of the Tarantino movies.
Mm-hmm.
I can hold two guns too, and actually have one in back too, for when one runs out, and I just pull it out and.
You know what? We'll bring you out to L.A. and you'll have your first Hollywood screen test.
I got to be honest with you. I had a very powerful 45 seconds in Almost Famous by Cameron Crowe, so it will be my second one. And I'll be there.
Right. Well, love to have you.
Yeah. This is, see, now it's gotten uncomfortable because it's gone on too long, hasn't it, Lawrence?
I will sit here all morning and chat with you about this.
All right. Well,
tell me about it.
Yeah. The movie is Innocent Voices. Our guest has been Lawrence Bender. It's playing here at the Cinema Village. Thanks for joining us, man.
Thanks a lot, Lawrence.
All right, guys.
You take care.
Thank you.
47 past. We'll come back and do what we do at the end. How would that be? It's Sarah America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan. Whether I'm waking up in Crawford, Texas, Washington, D.C., or Vacaville, California, I wake up with Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
51:52 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yo.
We're going to put this thing down here. Look at this. A Missouri radio talk show host was arrested yesterday for poisoning his wife to death in Massachusetts. He had moved to Missouri where he hosted the Party Line talk show. People knew he moved to Missouri after the death of his wife, but they didn't know that he poisoned her to death. He was arrested at the radio station on Monday morning. Wow, man, if this is in any way prescient of what I have to look forward to, I hope I don't go over the edge that far, Riley.
I don't think you'll go that far.
I know, you're very supportive.
That guy's probably a conservative.
I wish we knew more about him, but that's all I got.
I believe it was one of those, like, Boomer and the Nudge type morning shows.
The Party Line. Welcome to the Party Line. Right. Hey, ladies.
Why would he poison his wife? Hey, this would be funny.
Funny.
Why would he poison his wife?
$250,000 insurance policy.
It's the one that's the least messy and the hardest one to trace.
Yeah, we were
going to
hire a fake stunt guy. I mean, you do all sorts of things on radio.
It's hilarious. He sees the window. Yeah, every day he's like, I don't know what's wrong with my wife. And it just went on like that and got people very concerned. And then he topped out of the ratings when she passed away and had to move on.
He fed her antifreeze.
All right, this is not funny. I apologize for trying to make light of that situation, because that, my friends, is not funny. Arsenic, old school, funny. Antifreeze, that's just horrendous. What a bastard. That guy.
There you go.
Can we get some copies of his radio show? Can we podcast that? Pete Rose Jr. pleaded guilty yesterday on charges that he distributed GBL, a drug sold as a steroid option to his teammates in the Chattanooga Lookouts. I don't know nothing about those guys. I'm willing to bet that none of you sports brains in there, Pashman, just stopped by from Slovakia. Nice to see you. How the Chattanooga Lookouts doing this year, Pashman?
I got no idea.
They're double A.
Okay, which means nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
It means even less to me. So he was linked to a guy that was a nationwide distributor of this drug out of Murfreesboro, Tennessee, where they found 280 gallons. Apparently, listen to what this drug can do. It can build muscle, improve physical performance, enhance sex, reduce stress, and induce sleep. Man, that drug can do anything. I got to get me some of that. Wait, I guess it's just what you're thinking at the time.
How can something simultaneously improve sex and sleep?
I don't know, man. It makes you have better sex and then sleep right even faster and deeper than you would before. Man, all right, so what else do we got? This is an interesting story. A $100 million five-star, 23-story building is being erected in the center of what we predicted to be a theme park that's going to be huge. And it's going to be in Iraq. The Iraqi tourist place. Now you're putting the fake laugh with the real laugh?
We got this. Go.
It's called Meta Pashman.
Meta Pashman laughs. A whole audience of Pashmans. So the Iraqi tourist board, do I have this thing here? Listen to this. Although the investors' name for the park are being withheld for security reasons, we actually were able to find out some details about some of the features at the new Iraq theme park and hotels. I'll share them with you right now. For instance, they have one ride where you dodge around exploding obstacles. It's called the parking lot. Yeah. There's an area in the park where democracy has taken hold without any further fatalities. It's called Fantasyland. Also, in their version of It's a Small World, the company that builds everything in the park just happens to have been run by the Vice President of the United States. How do you like that? Here's some other highlights in Iraq Disney. You've got the Disney's Lights That Never Go On parade. Insurgents of the Sunni Triangle. Yeah, of course. Yes, and then, of course, Dumbo, the hijacked flying elephant.
Oh, my God.
Come on. This is grade-A comedy. And you can see the promise of the future die in the Tomorrowland Never Comes ride. Let's do some cliff notes, shall we? For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. On this date, 11 years ago, in 1994, Republicans won control of the House and Senate. In addition to the Republican Revolution, today is also the anniversary of Adolf Hitler's first attempt to seize power, the Beer Hall Putsch. Both had terrible consequences, but at least Hitler's included free beer. The Republican plan was called the Contract with America, which most historians have changed to a Contract on America. Pete Rose Jr., son of baseball's all-time hits leader, has pleaded guilty to distributing the performance-enhancing drug GBL to teammates. The guilty plea was a double blow to the Rose family. Pete Rose Sr. had bet 5-1 the plea would be innocent. GBL enhances athletic performance, but when taken orally, becomes GBH, the date rape drug. However, in both cases, it tends to increase scoring. Horrendous. Horrendous. Iraq is hoping to become a major tourist destination with plans for theme parks and five-star hotels. The planned hotel will have the usual accoutrements, plush suites, business centers, and a kiosk in the foyer where customers can get their stumps polished. Oh, man. Phrase of the day, my friends. Just drop this into conversation. Of course George Bush believes in torture. Wake up, sheeple. He spent his whole life making people tell him what he wants to hear. How do you like that? Dude, I'm excited, man.
Tomorrow.
David Cronenberg's going to be here to talk about his movies, which are the most bizarre movies ever made, and I'm a big fan. Excited.
Yeah, we're also going to have Mary Mapes, the senior producer who was fired in the wake of that Dan Rather National Guard scandal. And Mark Green on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.